I'd like to welcome you to our session called Setting the Stage to Combat Future Epidemics. So my name is Eva Harris, and I am a professor at UC Berkeley in Infectious Diseases and Vaccinology in the School of Public Health, and I'm also the director of the Center for Global Public Health. So I'd like to introduce our speakers, this is Julie Gerberding, and she is now Executive Vice President for Strategic Communications, Global Public Policy, and Population Health with Merck. And Joya Mukherjee is the Chief Medical Officer with Partners in Health. And you can find their full biographies in the program. So what we're going to talk about today, I'm actually going to read what we were assigned, and then we're going to tell what we're actually going to talk about. Experts say that the next epidemic will not be a question of if it will happen, but rather when. With that in mind, and looking at the recent catastrophic Ebola outbreak in West Africa, what are the lessons learned from this tragedy, and what needs to be done to ensure that it does not happen again? Governments in the affected countries played key roles in both stopping the spread of Ebola and failing to respond properly. How can troubled governments best react to epidemics? What role do business and philanthropic communities have in prevention of or reaction to an outbreak? And so what we're going to do is spend the first piece actually talking about the Ebola epidemic and lessons learned and the way forward. But we're also going to branch out to talk to positive examples in terms of capacity building and response to outbreaks, and also look at what is really needed for sustainable functioning health systems, both from scientific research in country all the way to health systems, healthcare, and looking to the future. And also, how do we measure that? And maybe we need to look at different types of models for measuring what long-term sustainability looks like. And so with that, I'd first just like to turn to both of our panelists to say, in terms of your perspectives, what are the lessons learned, and how do you think we can best prepare to avoid a similar situation, kind of from your lenses? Maybe Julie?
You know, I started having frontline responsibility for catastrophes right after 9/11, and we moved very quickly into a number of infectious disease outbreaks, including anthrax and SARS and monkeypox and so on and so forth. So I was really fascinated when the 9/11 Commission issued its report on what happened on 9/11, and they defined the four failures: the failure of imagination, the failure of policy, the failure of management, and then the failure of capability. And that was regarding a terrorism attack. But Mother Nature is the best terrorist. And I think we have to think about those four failures in the context of the Ebola outbreak in the same way that they have applied to many of the other serious public health outbreaks or pandemics that we've been preparing for and or dealing with. Probably the most important one in the context of Ebola is the failure of imagination. You know, we've known that bats carry hemorrhagic fever viruses in the region for a long time, and it was, if not known, at least knowable that those bats were moving closer and closer to urban populations of people, and people were moving out of traditionally isolated settings into urban environments. But we didn't really have the imagination that what had previously been small and relatively easily contained outbreaks could result in the kind of catastrophic disease incidents that we saw, at least in the three most affected countries. So what I think we need to frame our entire conversation with is we can't keep doing this over and over again. We need to imagine what can happen, and then we need to define the policies, the capabilities, and the management processes that will help us be successful and stop having these predictable surprises as if we'd never seen anything like this before and it came out of the blue.
And for those of you who don't know, Julie was the former director of CDC, which is what she was referring to in terms of all the rest of the catastrophes that fell upon her to make quick decisions and long aftermath. So maybe, Joya, from your point of view.
So Partners in Health is a non-governmental organization. We work in 10 countries, and we define ourselves by really trying to deliver healthcare in the public sector with the public sector and by working with local communities. We also define ourselves by making a very long-term, open-ended engagement. So we don't consider ourselves a disaster or an epidemic response organization, and yet, because of the countries we work in, we've often been called to attend to disasters. And I think I couldn't agree more with what Julie said, that the predictability of such disasters, particularly in settings of great poverty, is I mean, nearly 100%. And I think for us at Partners in Health, what we think is the key, the cornerstone of preparedness is to have decent health systems. The way that I think about it is, you know, if you have a very rotted and rickety railroad trestle, it's predictable that a train is going to fall through the cracks and have a catastrophe, and no one would scratch their head and say, wow, how did that happen? And yet that's kind of what's happening in health systems all over the world, you know, particularly in poor countries. And I've been working in global health, mostly in the field in Africa and Haiti and elsewhere for more than 20 years. And I've never seen health systems as bad as the ones in Liberia and Sierra Leone, the two countries that Partners in Health was invited to support as part of the Ebola crisis. So we never saw Ebola as the problem. The problem was the weak health systems, and Ebola was like a canary in the coal mine. And we've made a long-term commitment to these countries, and just this week I was asked by the government of Liberia to help them address their drug-resistant tuberculosis program, which again is they don't have a program. The tuberculosis control, an old, not epidemic threat by sort of New York Times estimations, but is, you know, killing many more people than Ebola did. And so we've got to have a basic level of health delivery and health services for people if we are going to prevent or at least respond to the next epidemic. There may be some things we could do to prevent, but at least if we can respond more quickly, we can mitigate death. And we've seen that in our work where we've had long-term systems, like in Haiti. As bad as cholera has been, we were able to respond very quickly because we had a long-term, very capable Haitian staff on the ground that could attend to people right away given a new epidemic threat.
Thank you. And I think I would extend, maybe depends on your points of view as well, but in terms of health systems, to include, for instance, the laboratory capacity
absolutely.
For diagnostics and surveillance. And that happens to be a particular love of mine. And in addition to my work at UC Berkeley, I also have founded a nonprofit called Sustainable Sciences Institute, which is very much devoted to building scientific capacity. And so in Nicaragua, where we've been working for almost 30 years, we've actually been able to stay ahead of the epidemic. So we have, in just many years of training the staff, people know how to run protocols, run assays, et cetera, but might be missing the particular sequences to you know, amplify the next Ebola or chikungunya or Zika or, you know, but we've been able to, through academic partnerships, get wind of something coming in. I managed to get primers or get monoclonals, bring it down, and they have the capacity to set up the assays and then actually validate them and decentralize them. And that's happened now maybe 5 or 6 times, pandemic flu, et cetera, and always ahead of the game, even though Nicaragua is actually a very small country, second poorest country in the hemisphere. But, you know, I was kind of thinking about the positive example. So that would be maybe one I would give. But I know that, you know, as you said, you're on the ground in 10 countries, and Rwanda, Lesotho, and Peru, others have been touted as there's actually positive in there, and certainly in the partnerships with Merck and your work at CDC as well. So I kind of was thinking of, you know, Ebola as kind of the and unfortunately negative example, but where can we draw positive examples that are already ongoing and can be repeated in the future? So I don't know.
One of the obvious situations that comes up every time there's a significant public health crisis is the problem is bigger than the government. The government is necessary, but it's not sufficient to solve the problem. And so you have to engage the broader partnerships with civil society, whether that's non-governmental organizations, faith-based organizations, academic organizations, and increasingly the private sector. Now, in the case of an infectious disease outbreak, companies that make vaccines, companies that make drugs, companies that make diagnostics all of a sudden have to step forward and really figure out how can we do this? Do we have the capability? What is our responsibility? How can we be helpful? And I'll tell you, even though we're not there yet. We don't have an approved vaccine for Ebola. We have made more progress on a vaccine for Ebola than we have ever made at this speed for any single other infectious disease. So the fact that there is a published report defining efficacy of an Ebola vaccine within months of its initial introduction is, from where we sat at Merck, a pretty heroic effort, of which there's not a profit motive. It is simply we had a capability. We didn't invent it. Other people made the invention. But it's the recognition that when it comes to scaling something large enough or doing something fast enough to solve a public health problem, you have to have private sector participation, because little NGOs are not big enough to do that. And we have to figure out how to do that ahead of the curve, before we're trying to solve a crisis. How do we get those partnerships to work effectively during the planning phase and have protocols for research studies or diagnostics or for controlled trials of therapies or vaccines that we can pull off the shelf, change the name of the compound or the of the vaccine, but roll them out with pre-existing agreements, pre-existing consent processes, pre-existing importation rules and regulations, pre-existing supply chain plans, all of the logistic things that go into even studying a vaccine had to be solved on the fly in three of the most difficult countries in the world in terms of infrastructure and health system development. That is not something that can be done without government leadership, but it also increasingly takes really strong public-private partnerships. And I think we're just at the beginning of really appreciating how powerful those partnerships can be. The United Nations has just launched its Sustainable Development Goals. And one of the cornerstones of the new Sustainable Development Goals is the concept that private sector engagement is going to be necessary for sustained development. That means the private sector has to step up and be more than philanthropy at the table. We have to be part of systems development, part of true partnership, meaning we give as much as we get, and we have to be willing to roll up our sleeves and stay in it for the long haul. So I couldn't be more thrilled with the UN approach to the Sustainable Development Goals, but I think we're just at the very beginning of figuring out what does that really mean.
I just want to second that. I mean, I think that's key. And, there are positive examples of responding to epidemic threats. I actually think there's a lot positive from Ebola itself. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the positive aspects was a very strong set of partnerships that were in many cases pre-existing and some cases created on the fly. We could have done better. And as Julie said, sort of have more planning in certainly, but the fact that we could be doing research simultaneously with delivering care in this and infection control in this and developing lab capacity in the setting of a massive international crisis, I think was stunning. And exactly what you said, Eva, too, to see some of the basic lab services get massively upgraded. I mean, there was the Dutch government, for example, supported Sierra Leone with these very small types of reactors, the PCR machines that were in a box, all self-contained, and they were training a lot of local professionals to run those. So, there was the capacity building in real time, and those can be used for future epidemics. They're not going to go away. And so I think there were things, the fact that vaccines were developed and tried. Our group was involved in doing a study of a new rapid diagnosis in the line of fire. While we were providing care for thousands of people, we were also studying a rapid diagnosis. So I think, and that couldn't have happened without the private sector, without the government themselves, and without NGOs sort of at the front line trying to assist in that. So I think there were some great examples of collaboration. I mean, despite the very high death toll, I think it could have been much worse. And I think that we really were able to work side by side across, a very kind of interdisciplinary, multi-partner framework.
That's great. There's so many little points there that I wanted to go off.
Yeah, yeah.
But one of the things that I hear that we haven't really discussed yet, which for me is very important, is the role of community and community engagement mm-hmm. and community sensitivity. Mm-hmm. I think, in a way, Ebola was very an amazing example of that.
Yeah.
But in every place, I mean, certainly we've found, for something to be sustainable and to be really implemented, people need to feel ownership and,
yeah.
and buy in, not just... Not in just words. I mean, anything that's from afar or from mm-hmm. above, you know, mm-hmm. will work in the moment, but will not have yeah. the longevity. And
yeah.
so I think, at least in our work, has been very much about like how to really motivate or bring evidence to people so that it's their own evidence
right.
and it's their own decisions.
Right.
And of
right.
course, in partnership, because it does have to go beyond. But I think it's really important is the how and
mm-hmm.
the how the community is engaged. And I
yeah.
think, I know, well, both of you have had a lot of experience mm-hmm. with that. I think maybe we can discuss that with the
yeah.
audience about how that yeah. played in both through the Ebola and also how we can bring that yeah. in the future.
I mean, we certainly feel at Partners in Health that community participation is absolutely critical to the delivery of care, particularly if one is to reach equity. The people
exactly.
who are farthest from the health center, the people who are the most vulnerable, the people who are marginalized. And we have a staff around the world of about 16,000 people. We're actually a relatively small organization, but 80% of them are community health workers. So are people who are paid to be extensions of the health system. So not to supplant the health system, but to extend the care delivery value chain to the home, to the village level. So whether it's delivering meds for HIV or tuberculosis, or educating and encouraging people to come forward if they have symptoms of Ebola, we've found that paid, supervised, well-trained community health workers as a professional cadre is a very important part of achieving equity and really meeting the demands of the population. Interestingly, in Ebola, we learned a lot of lessons from the HIV movement and rapidly hired survivors. And many of our community health workers were survivors for a couple of reasons. One is we thought, at least epidemiologically, they weren't as at risk because they probably had some immunity in surviving. But most importantly, they had the lived experience of going through this disease, coming out the other side, and they could help people be less fearful to come forward. So we hired more than 700 survivors who were very engaged in doing education, trying to get people to receive care, and destigmatizing to some extent the idea that Ebola is a death sentence, that you can live and you can come forward and get help. And the earlier you get help, the more likely we are to be able to save you. So I think that role of community, particularly community members who have had the experience with a disease, a condition. You know, we hire many mothers, for example, to be supporters, or we say accompanators of pregnancy and childbirth, because we know they know what that's like and what those stresses are and the risks are. So we feel that that engagement of community is a very powerful tool. And I think in terms of epidemic threats, similarly, these are people who understand the communities. They understand where are the pockets, where are the really vulnerable populations. You know, the community health worker came to me in Sierra Leone in the height of the epidemic and said that we really have a problem in this one area. It's cut off by any landmass, and we're going to have to rent a canoe. Can you help us rent a canoe to get to these families? And the community health workers went out there, and they found 20 people who were infected in this area. So those kind of areas, you know, only the community members know about that. And if we really want to get to epidemic control, it can't just be centrally driven.
But I'm thinking about this conversation and what Eva introduced the session about. Oh, there are things about Ebola that are absolutely unique to the
mm-hmm.
environment in
mm-hmm.
the least developed parts of the world, but we shouldn't forget that it was also quite challenging in the United
yes.
States.
Good point.
We really weren't prepared to manage the diagnosis or the isolation and treatment of people mm-hmm. in a country that has mm-hmm. a much better developed
yes.
health system. One
yeah.
could argue if we've reached perfection yet, but I think we certainly have all of those resources. And so we do have to think globally
mm-hmm.
Because there's no separation of any of these infectious diseases anymore. This is all one small world, and
mm-hmm.
We have to have solutions that actually are as equitably distributed as possible, but also recognize that we can't just think of it as a threat over there. It's
mm-hmm.
going to be a threat here, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, I was just handed a question, which is exactly what I was going to bring up next, which kind of was essentially, I mean, you were mentioning about hiring community workers. In our experience, we also work with volunteers and really try and bring it out with brigadas, with brigades, and out into the residents themselves. In other words, and the question here is about the role of education. And in our experience, it's very much whatever the problem is, explaining it in terms that can really like make a click in the mind of normal, just resident citizens, and once they understand what the problem really is,
excuse me,
then there's like this myriad of incredible solutions that come up, which would never have been thought of before. And so, you know, for instance, in our one case, we work on dengue and a bunch of viral pathogens that are transmitted by mosquitoes. And so the big issue is that the mosquitoes grow in water around people's homes. And so there's all kinds of decisions that have been made from afar. But one of the biggest problems are tires. And so that because they can gather water. And so there's this huge problem. How do you get rid of tires? And just explaining what was the most important thing about the disease, it became the life cycle of the mosquito, that people wanted to understand what the life cycle was. And once they, because what you do is you say, stop the mosquito. So that's great. They understand that the virus is born by a mosquito. But then you're supposed to get rid of standing water. And in like 50, 70 years of public health, no one explained to people why you would get rid of the water. No one ever said, this is where the mosquito grows. Mm-hmm. And once you understood, and people started, then all of a sudden there was all these ideas that came up, including making staircases and bridges out of the tires, you know, so filling them with earth so that they couldn't be filled with water, but then putting them to use. And so I think that like there's a lot of, you know, of ingenuity that comes and in our case. But the question here also is, what is the role of education? And very much in Ebola, I mean, there was this issue of not trusting medical advice. So this this idea of kind of bringing knowledge in a way that's non-threatening, but is really kind of can also open to innovation from community. And so maybe kind of from both of your perspectives, like experiences with that or seeing how that could be brought into the future.
Now, I think when polled, Americans will say that they would prefer to receive their information about a health crisis from their local doctor, as opposed to any other official or government leader or CDC director, for that matter. And I think at a universal level, it's really the more local the resource is, the more trusted the resource is going to be. And we really have to remember that. Usually governments and government leaders want to step forward and be the voice, but they're usually the least trusted. And that it's getting that perspective out to the people who are normal leaders in the community and helping them be the translators of the message and the information and the resource for engagement. I think that's probably a pretty universal concept.
I agree. Yeah, I agree.
And so we have another. Before we move, in about 5 minutes, we're going to move really on to the questions from the audience. But the one other element that came up in your discussions, but I wanted to address a little bit more frontally, was the issue of long term, because you know, there are pandemics, there is a response, and then, like you say, then there'll be another one. So what do we do for long term, and are we investing in the right?
Yeah,
I mean, we've talked before about the importance of investing in people, but it's not very sexy to invest in people.
Right.
People want to invest in gadgets. So how do we actually turn that around?
Yeah, I'll start by saying, you know, I think that the long-term development of, you know, a workforce, both community, facility-based, centrally in these countries, is the best vaccine that we can have, even to deliver vaccines.
Yeah.
Because we too often have set up public health projects on sort of a short-term cadre of people who parachute in, parachute out, or, you know, paying some cadre of people for a couple of weeks, and then that goes away. We really need a long-term cadre, and that investment needs to be supported at the highest levels. And I think, you know, we're happy to see that our one of our co-founders and partners in health, Jim Kim, is now president of the World Bank, and talking a lot about what kind of resources we would need globally to assure, you know, some responsiveness to these kind of pandemic threats. And really a lot of it is, you know, has to be about long-term training. So at Partners in Health, we've developed residency programs in medicine, advanced practice programs in nursing, official credentialing of community health workers, mm-hmm. and really trying to scale these things nationally. So in Rwanda, you know, a country that is really turning the tide on some yeah. major epidemics and having some real improvement of health outcomes, there are large-scale training programs that are being run by the government with support of partners like ours, but also with support of many academic universities in the United States to train future doctors, nurses, health managers. And I think those, when you see that a country can do that with the support of partners, some of those partners are private sector, some are donors, some are NGOs, that really can help turn the tide and prevent future epidemics. To me, I felt that it would have been very hard for Ebola to sweep through Rwanda the way it had mm-hmm. Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea, though it's a very poor country. And it's only 20 years out from one of the most notorious conflicts, certainly in the 20th century. The building of human capacity to do surveillance and follow-up, laboratory capacity at the central level, really was somewhat of an inoculation. Not to say it could never happen, but I think had it happened, it would have been much more possible to contain it, to know about it sooner, to mm-hmm. stay ahead of it. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's what we're really trying to invest in, the long term of systems development and human capacity.
I think there's also an important role for the private sector in sustainability. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I don't have a number, but I think if you added up all of the money that corporations spend on what is commonly known as corporate social responsibility mm-hmm. that is targeting global health programs, it's an enormous number. Yes. I'm sure it's in the many billions of yes. dollars if you add it all up. But those investments tend to be projects.
Yeah.
And often they're not designed with sustainability in mind. Mm-hmm. I happen to be now responsible for a project that is trying to take a different tactic. It's a $500 million program. It's called Merck for Mothers, and instead of doing projects, we've tried to find out from government leaders in countries and from the UN organizations, what is it that you think a pharmaceutical or vaccine company could uniquely do that other people probably can't do that would be really helpful for you to solve this problem over the long run? Mm-hmm. So it's a different mindset, but I do see more and more a movement toward changing the framework of the corporate social responsibility investment, much more oriented toward, we don't want to keep doing projects. We actually mm-hmm. want to help develop a health system that mm-hmm. works and that it gives exactly what you've been talking mm-hmm. about, a health system that is there for the country, that's organized by the country, that has the intrinsic human resources and capabilities, mm-hmm. in a sense, health markets. Mm-hmm. And as we mm-hmm. see more and more, even some of the least developed countries, Rwanda has health insurance now, mm-hmm. and they have the capacity to take care of their mm-hmm. own citizens, mm-hmm. and I'm sure that will mature and become even more sophisticated over mm-hmm. time. But we're just at the beginning of this journey, and mm-hmm. that's why I love my job, because I feel like we're yeah. really at the beginning of a different mental model and potentially a very different way of engagement. I wish, you know, the whole world was ready for that, but I think we have a real opportunity to try to be a force of sustainable health system development, not just the kind of really good work that our project-based approach has traditionally yeah. accomplished.
And I think to just take off a little bit on this project-based model, a lot of the money from donors to NGOs on the mm-hmm. NGO side is around this notion of train the trainer, that, you know, if you can mm-hmm. train a person, then that person can, it's great in theory. But what it does is really projectize health and pulls people out of their workplace to do a training on the new malaria treatment. And you sit in the capital city for 5 days and you see PowerPoint slides and you're not on the front lines, you're not providing care, and then you move back to your health center, which doesn't have the facility, doesn't have mentoring for you. And a lot of the money in development is wrapped up in this project model of train the trainer, which is very short term. And what the providers need is long-term side-by-side mentoring, the kind of mentoring we had when we were trainees. I mean, I had 9 years of postgraduate mentoring between all of my residency and fellowship and whatnot. And yet we put some of the least trained health professionals on the front line with almost no mentoring, and then think that a five-day workshop in the Capitol is going to teach them how to do very complicated, sophisticated things. So just as Julie is saying, we've got to change from the private sector, we also have to change from the NGO side what we consider to be capacity building. Mm-hmm. I don't see those Capital City train the trainer. And what is driving them is a kind of donor mentality that is, we don't want to pay for long-term salaries. We don't want to pay for long-term development. We want a short-term thing. We want to show metrics that say, we've had 20 people trained. Good. Is that training effective? Does it really impact the lives of people? Is it really going to provide the confidence and the skill set that the providers need? I would say often it's not, but it can be counted. So we've got to think of a different way to look long-term at outcomes and you know, to really make a difference.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. It's definitely one of the things that we did in SSI and our nonprofit was to do, it was always in-country workshops, but bringing, you know, all the methods exactly to the place, not the Capitol, but up, you know, so but trying to do, you know, some technique up at, you know, 12,000 feet is very different from at sea level when it depends that water boils at 80 degrees or 89 degrees and not, you know, so all these things that we were like put in there with people figuring it out, you know, and then that's really the only way to at least get through some of the technical hurdles. Yeah. But boy, is it ever difficult to raise money for this kind of thing. And this is actually dovetails into another question, which is kind of what are the critical technologies or policy changes that need to be implemented to combat the next public health issue? And I think we're kind of have been talking around this issue in terms of maybe a sea change in terms of the mentality, because a lot has to do with funding of where this would go, but maybe policy changes could be incorporated into that discussion. So,
Oh, you know, we're talking about sustainability, and it's just absolutely, I can say this now without any fear of retribution, it's embarrassing to me and I think to our country that we have such a erratic way of funding these kinds of public health preparedness programs. We fund them dramatically at great expense after the fact, and then we let the funding dwindle to nothing until the next crisis occurs, and then we scale up again in a panic, and it's absolutely impossible for us to sustain preparedness in the United States, let alone be a good and reliable partner for the kinds of long-term sustainable preparedness investments that we need to share accountability with on a global basis. And I, you know, I understand that people will never, nor should they, be constantly thinking about the possibility of a, of an outbreak or a pandemic, but government leaders need to do that, and we need to really get past this, you know, cut when we need money for some other competing urgent priority without really recognizing that this requires sustained investment. We're wasting a lot of money by starting and stopping.
And I think we're wasting money and we're hurting people in the process, because the very same waxing and waning funding streams are also what is completely hamstringing the delivery of day-to-day care, the lack of which is killing many more people. More children die of malaria and diarrheal disease than Ebola in the countries that are affected, and somehow that doesn't make headlines. And those are things that are imminently treatable, preventable, but you need a functioning system to deal with those. And so, I mean, I agree that, that crisis mode, the project mode, these are things that are changeable. I mean, most of you here are Americans. A lot of this is driven by your taxpayer dollars supporting U.S. assistance. We need to change the framing of the architecture of aid so that we can look at long-term health and the delivery of health care as a basic human right, and how do we collectively come together to assure that for people all over the world, in our own country included. I think it's critical.
Yes, good. So that's our next policy change. Very good. Interesting, a couple questions. Now we're in the questions period, but from around the kind of general area of community, but some comment questions about how do you deal with, say, communities that are opposed to immunization, or, you know, both like in this country or in others. Of course, there's been issues with polio vaccination and, you know, so from the opposite side of policy, but to like difficult kind of issues in terms of movements, both here and also in terms of, what, for instance, there's been the last bits of the polio eradication have been very, very difficult for similar reasons, but very different in So I don't know if you have any comments around
Julie,
some of those issues.
Do you have thoughts on California? We're in the epicenter of vaccine refusal here.
I'll disclose two things. One of my first job at Merck was to be responsible for the vaccine division. So I have a lot of frontline experience and impressions about this issue. But also, I'm still on the faculty at UCSF, and you know, I watched with horror the measles outbreak in California. It was a heartbreaking situation, and again, a public health embarrassment. And I've thought a lot about this issue of vaccine hesitancy and or vaccine refusal. Much of our problem is hesitancy. And I think we do need to have, as clinicians, we need to have a different mindset about how we talk to parents about immunization of their children. When you are a parent and you have never seen these diseases, it doesn't really matter what your left brain knows about risk or whatever is on the immunization fact sheet. You're feeling something. You're feeling that I'm about to let somebody stick my child with a sharp object. Mm-hmm. And if there's any chance that this could possibly cause a problem for my child, I'm going to be apprehensive and nervous about it. That's normal. All right. Parents feel right. That way. And we need to acknowledge that this is kind of a normal part of being a parent and allow people to experience that normal human reaction. But as doctors in that situation, we also have to be able to step up and say, but as your pediatrician, mm-hmm. I must tell you that I strongly urge you to get this vaccine now because it is the right thing to do to protect mm-hmm. your baby. Mm-hmm. We need the clinicians mm-hmm. to not demonstrate vaccine hesitancy.
Yeah.
And that's where I think we're running into some debates and we're getting mixed messages out there in front of parents who are working through this. Now, of course, there is another faction of parent, another faction of the community that is not just refusing vaccines, but is proselytizing junk science and really creating a true public health hazard. And I want to separate those mm-hmm. two groups of people. Mm-hmm. It's not an easy solution, but I think taking the stance of you're wrong, you know, you're bad, this is not good for our community, that's not helpful to parents. We need to help them understand and process before they get to the point where the baby's sitting on their lap and they're going through it. And just reassure people, this is part of what we do. And when it comes to HPV vaccine, many physicians hesitate to offer HPV vaccine because they think it requires them to have a long and complicated discussion of sex. Now, you know, I cannot really subscribe to that point of view. I think that it's just like any other vaccine. Oh, you're 12 years old, it's time for your HPV vaccine. This vaccine prevents cancer.
Yeah, done.
Period.
Yeah.
Done. End of story.
Yeah.
We do not need to have the birds and bees
birds
conversation.
Yeah, I want to add just a sort of an additional global perspective, which I'm sure, you know, Julie and Ava also have experienced. I believe that In the global context, especially in very poor communities in northern Nigeria and some rural parts of India, part of the vaccine refusal is somewhat of a disgust and disconnect between the helpers, the vaccinators, the brigades, and the actual needs of the community. When you look at some of the communities that have no health systems, no access to running water, no modern sanitation, and then they have a bunch of people saying, you need your polio vaccine, just not a ranking priority for them. And I think that we have to recognize that if you, my experience, personal experience, having given many thousands of vaccinations, is if you're providing comprehensive care, most reasonable people, I mean, with some of this other stuff aside, will accept that as a comprehensive part of the package of care. But I think we're often seen as aid workers trying to impose an external agenda without being present in the community. And I think a lot of the vaccine refusal that's going on in the Global South is because people don't feel that health is there to serve them and that these programs are really externally driven with some other agenda. For good reason, they feel like that, because a lot of the intervention of the West is externally driven for some other agenda. So, you know, I think that we need to do a better job. And, you know, frankly, the fact that, and I'm sure this was a terrible thing to CDC and others, the fact that a vaccine program was used, and this is a matter of public record, to find Osama bin Laden's family in Pakistan is the kinds of suspicions that people have. And so there are good reasons there. And so we have to, this is why we feel that local capacity building, local providers, local administration of whatever it is so critical. And those long-term, you know, again, back to what Julie said, it's your own doctor, it's your own nurse, it's your own community saying, and by the way, these are the vaccines your kid needs now, very different from people driving up in a truck and trying to administer vaccines.
I've always been interested in the going out of this country. I mean, people in many countries see the benefit of vaccines.
For sure.
So, and even for vaccine trials, places where I was kind of worried about, ooh, is this, but no, you know, other places, they just want to be part of the trial. They want to support vaccines because they really see the benefit.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes here we might not see the benefit because, you know, they're not, the diseases aren't as ever present. And so I think
and
that
there
that's
is,
also part
I think we're at a very uniquely scary moment around junk science, and we're very puritanical about sex and things like that. And we did a very small pilot. We were one of the first pilots working with Merck on the human papilloma virus vaccine in Haiti. And we vaccinated a relatively small cohort of adolescent girls in Haiti starting in December of 2009. And as many of you remember, the earthquake, tragic earthquake, happened in January 12th of 2010. And we still were able to complete the three-dose series for 90% of those children. So why? Because we had very deep roots in the community, because we were a known entity. And the parents did want their children, their young daughters, to be vaccinated. So, I mean, I think it's very possible, even in the setting of a very chaotic and tragic
Rwanda, 97% of the girls have received all three doses of their HPV vaccine.
Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing.
It is quite a bit
amazing.
Higher than it is in the United States.
Yeah.
That's really amazing. So we've kind of covered a lot of ground and bringing the different sectors together, but one we didn't is the role of global organizations, global agencies. So one question is, how do you think the WHO performed during the Ebola crisis, and what should its role be during the next crisis? And not just the WHO per se, but like, what's the role of global organizations? So that kind of, that's one layer that we haven't really directly discussed, kind of obliquely by CDC, but in the global realm.
I have a very different take on I don't think the WHO performed or didn't perform well. I don't think the WHO has ever been funded to be an implementation organization. And there was a mythology around the WHO that they should be dealing with Ebola. They're really a standard-setting body. They help to set guidelines. They support countries in rolling out guidelines. They put a lot of people on the ground to fight Ebola and incurred a fairly high death toll among WHO workers, particularly those who were Ugandan working in Sierra Leone and Liberia, who were poorly protected. I think if we want the WHO to function as they are, which is largely as a standard-setting body, I think they can continue. If we want the WHO to play a larger role in epidemic threat control, I think they would have to be funded in a very, very different way. So my view is, I think they did more than I would have expected in terms of the frontline implementation. But it's not really ever been their role.
I think it's also very important that we have a strong WHO.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We need WHO to be successful. Mm-hmm. And as one of the major funding countries, the United States has a special opportunity to help WHO solve some of its structural problems, which have to do with the way the organization is governed and the way decisions are made at the regional level and even at the country level. So rather than blame the WHO for not being able to manage this dreadful outbreak, this perfect storm of factors going on in this particular part of West Africa, I think we need to take a hard look at what can we do to help that organization be a strong force of standard setting and the ability to enforce the standards that they do bring forward with the full support and weight of the UN agencies as a body, but also the member countries. And I completely concur that it is not ever designed to be an implementation agency. Mm-hmm. Much of the implementation workforce of WHO is borrowed from mm-hmm. lots of other organizations, mm-hmm. including CDC and mm-hmm. the European public health entities, as well as the in-country support. So it is a mythology, mm-hmm. and we need to help them mm-hmm. Strengthen their capability, not blame them for mm-hmm. something that was not optimally exercise when it really isn't in their remit to do that mm-hmm. in the first place.
Mm-hmm. And how about, I mean, there's a lot of big role for, well, Partners in Health, Médecins Sans Frontières, I mean, mm-hmm. Doctors Without Borders. I mean, there's been, like, there's a lot of, for instance, in the Ebola outbreak, a lot of the work was done mm-hmm. in, by NGOs kind of rising to the occasion, but mm-hmm. also, you know, governments. So it was managing all of that was also yeah. really challenging in terms of, you know, I guess the role for international organizations that are respected and have a role to be able to decide, you know, how yeah. all that happens. So
yeah, I mean, Médecins Sans Frontières is absolutely an organization of heroes. The role they played in Ebola should never, ever be, you know, underestimated. They shouldered the entirety of the response along with the relatively paltry government efforts given these very, very poor governments for many months. And so I am a huge fan, and I think, but, you know, the idea that one NGO can, you know, shoulder the burden of this is just absurd. And I think we can't think that an NGO, even a great one like MSF, can do that. And they were begging for help from April of 2014. Even against, you know, other people, and including the WHO, saying this was not a big epidemic threat, it was not a crisis. I mean, they really sounded the alarm, and they tried to get others in the water. And they have a lot of experience in hemorrhagic fever, I mean, more than any other organization. So they did great work. They certainly trained the majority of our staff. Our approach was a bit different. We did not set up separate Ebola units. We tried to support the government in what they were trying to do, which was quite messy. If I had to make the decision as I did then, as chief medical officer now, I would make the same decision. We waded into several large facilities in Sierra Leone that the government was trying to provide Ebola care. But they were not structurally designed for mm-hmm. the complexities of Ebola, and we tried to retrofit them the best we could. We tried to provide enough protective equipment for the entire Sierra Leonean staff that was already working there in dreadful conditions. It was not a beautiful, sexy way to work. Not that anything about Ebola was sexy, but it was not. But I'm proud mm-hmm. of what we did. It was a bit controversial when we had one of our American staff and a Sierra Leonean public sector staff infected. But there were many, many workers that were infected and through this, and we lost neither of them, thank God. But it, you know, that was a different approach. It's still the approach we would always choose to take, but I think we've got to really, again, help governments to be prepared for future epidemics rather than try to scramble and have a potpourri yeah. of different approaches, which is what happened.
Mm-hmm. So kind of changing gears, one of the questions is, do you see a role for health and, like, social marketing around health, and how does that play in radio, TV, internet to help change and inform, like, health behavior, for instance? So,
well, certainly it's a major force. Even in Ebola, if you were there, the billboards, the social media engagement, I mean, mm-hmm. through simple things like brochures, the public service announcements, but then enormous billboards. And mm-hmm. Yesterday I was flying in here and the conveyor belt broke at the airport in San Francisco International. And so I was standing for an extremely long time at the baggage claim. And the CDC has a social media campaign about measles, dengue
here
and influenza virus and hand washing, and they're playing it over and over again at the baggage carousel. And I thought, this is fantastic. This is just fantastic. It was excellent. So, you know, obviously social media is one of the really most important channels of mass communication, and the repetition is really important. And I think the smartphones and the access to peer-to-peer communication through the social media channels are going to be the baseline as we go forward in the future. It's fun.
There's also a lot of very innovative ways. I mean, one of my classes, the students had found just fantastic, like soap operas on HIV and Africa. Yeah. I mean, really good. And in our dengue work, the reggaetoneros, so like essentially made dengue raps. It's a hip hop on dengue and on how to prevent. And so it's always it's very exciting to get it in. Like, I mean, it's good to have it on at the conveyor belt. But then, like, you know, have it like really kind of into the culture in another way is really powerful.
I think I want to just take that question apart a little bit, because I think there's the social media aspect, which, you know, as a lifelong HIV activist, I think we've seen so much change around HIV because of social media and unbelievable engagement at the grassroots level from musicians, from actors, from drama groups in Africa and whatnot. So that's great, and I think social marketing is a particular term that often is used to get people to change health behaviors that commoditize certain certain issues around health behavior. And the classic example is mosquito nets. So to have billboards and to get people to value mosquito net enough to buy it, those things have been studied. And we know that any charge for a health commodity will always be a barrier to the poorest and the most vulnerable. And those studies were done at MIT by the Poverty Action Lab, as well as others, that, you know, to take something that's really life-saving, like a mosquito net, a condom, these kind of things, if you put a charge on those, even with a good social marketing campaign, they will lock out the lowest quintile of the population, more or less. And so I think it's very important to say, yes, social media is a very important tool. Social marketing, if it's used as too much of a financial barrier, will not be distributed equitably in terms of getting health products and health promotion and health-seeking behavior to the poorest of the poor.
So we have one that's, I guess for Julie maybe, when private sectors mass produce a vaccine, is the control over price not a problem at times? So how do you deal to a society, like this is the public good aspect versus how does one handle that?
I think one of the most important things that's happened in terms of vaccine preventable diseases is the Gavi mechanism.
Yes, absolutely.
So the ability to procure large volumes of vaccine for the poorest people in the world at an affordable price, and to do that in a way that works for the manufacturers, but also really works for the governments and the people who are in most need of vaccine. When I went to Merck, one of the first things that happened to me was I visited a clinic that I've been involved with for a number of years in Uganda. And it's a very successful HIV clinic. It's fantastic, and it really has created a sustainable health system there with the best possible care for a large number of people. But I was visiting with one of the women who was on antiretroviral therapy, and there was a pool of blood under her because she was bleeding from cervical cancer that had not been diagnosed. And, you know, cervical cancer is the leading cause of cancer among women in Africa, confounded by HIV infection. I just took a job at a company who makes one of the two really terrific HPV vaccines. How could I sleep at night, you know, knowing that we did not have our vaccine in Uganda? So we made a very strong commitment. We'd figure it out. And we didn't think we could do it because it's expensive to make it relative to what people in Africa can afford to pay. But by working with Gavi and getting that volume commitment and figuring out how we could improve our own production capability, the more volume, the cheaper a vaccine is per unit dose, we were able to do it. And so we've been able to license the vaccine and are starting immunization programs all over Africa. So it can be done. It's not easy, don't get me wrong, and it's controversial because obviously we charge a price there that is cost, meaning there's no profit for the vaccine that we present to the Gavi market, and we offset that with the prices that we pay in the United mm-hmm. States. And the middle-income countries pay a price that's somewhere in between those extremes. And a lot of people don't think that's fair, including some politicians. I myself think that it works on economic grounds, because yes. in the United States, if you save a woman from cervical cancer, yeah. the cost that it would take yes. to care for someone with cervical cancer is very high, and therefore you're saving a very large amount of money. In Africa, if a woman gets cervical cancer, it costs nothing because right. she dies. Yeah. And so you're not really saving. If you're doing a health economic analysis, you couldn't possibly justify a price for a vaccine that was anything other than the lowest possible price you could imagine. So in between those extremes, it's called Ramsey pricing, if you want to look mm-hmm. it up and read about it. But it's one way of trying yes. to balance profit, value, health economic value, and access. And mm-hmm. I think we've proven that you can get vaccines to the poorest people.
Yes.
The next challenge we have is we have a new vaccine that has broader coverage, so we'll actually cover 90% of the strains that cause HPV cancer. And it's because it's got 9 strains of virus instead of 4, it's going to be more expensive to make. So the question is, how can we get that one into mm-hmm. Africa? Because that's where it's needed the most. Mm-hmm. Those yeah. girls are not screened. Yeah. There's no treatment yeah. for cancer. Those people need this vaccine yeah. the very mm-hmm. most. And how are we going to make that one cheap enough? Mm-hmm. It's hard. It's really hard. But I think it can be done. Mm-hmm. We need help.
Yeah, well, we'll help you.
Well, I mean, this is actually a nice example of playing together. I mean, there's one, I don't know if you've heard, there's this parable of the sandbox. And so we talk about multidisciplinary and interdisciplinary and transdisciplinary. And you can see that as like everyone, the kids being in a sandbox box, and each with their discipline or their sector mm-hmm. in this mm-hmm. case. And mm-hmm. so if you can be multidisciplinary and all the kids are in the same sandbox, but they're facing out and just making their own sandcastles, but at least they're in the same sandbox. And then you have, I can't remember, the interdisciplinary, where they're all facing together, but they're still making their own sandcastles. And what you really want, and this is like the transdisciplinary or whatever, nirvana, mm-hmm. where they're all together making the same castle, mm-hmm. you know. And I think that, and just like kind of your final words, because I think we're almost running out of time in terms of, you know, how to make us all build the same castle. Mm-hmm. I think there's some really good evidence here. You're taking you're at a private company, but you're, you know, nonetheless able to work with Gavi in the public sector, you know, to make mm-hmm. vaccines available. You and the nonprofit are able to then partner mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. bring them out. But, you know, we bring in community this way. And mm-hmm. one other question maybe was around, you know, how do you respect cultural rights, you know, mm-hmm. while protecting people from epidemics and bringing mm-hmm. that aspect mm-hmm. in as well. Then governments can be mm-hmm. really bulky and difficult, but have to be brought in. So, you know, I think there's all these different elements that come into making that castle. And I don't know if any kind of either issues or kind of thoughts towards the future about kind of really making the transsectoral, I think, approach is what we're really talking about here.
You know, in an ideal world, the government would be the convener of the planning. Mm-hmm. And as I like to think of horizontal planning, vertical execution. Mm-hmm. So if you can get a country plan for a health system, or a country plan for Ebola, or a country plan for malaria, if you're still at a point where you need categorical planning as opposed to more systemic planning, you know, if the government just simply doesn't have the capability to do it, it's awfully hard to bring the partners together mm-hmm. to build that sandcastle.
True.
But if you can collaborate with the government and really continuously respect the importance that the government have the leadership accountability, I think they gain confidence mm-hmm. and experience mm-hmm. and you're a lot better off. The PEPFAR program is an example where there was a great deal of horizontal planning and hopefully vertical execution, mm-hmm. even though it's a categorical mm-hmm. program. But it was still mainly a U.S. Mm-hmm. planning process, right. mm-hmm. not a country-level yes. planning yes. process, where the country was planning for the U.S. investment, the British investment, the Norwegian yeah. investment, the Gates investment. And I think that's the kind of the 2.0 right. version of what right. we need is mm-hmm. a uniform plan mm-hmm. that people collaborate in developing, and then everybody knows what piece of it they're going to help execute. Mm-hmm. Maybe a fantasy, but I think we want to try to get there.
I think think Rwanda is a great example of that. And I think, you know, if I look at our invitation at Partners in Health to Rwanda in 2004, you know, we've been now, we just celebrated our 10th anniversary working there together with the government. And what we saw was very clear government planning. And whether it was PEPFAR funding, Global Fund funding, or World Bank funding for HIV, it was the government's role, even though the government didn't have control over the money in some cases, like particularly in the case of PEPFAR. They said, this is our plan, and you, American organization, if you don't implement it in this way, you can leave. And they stuck to it. And it made the government sometimes quite unpopular, but it did work to coordinate partners. And you know, one of the roles that I feel proud of playing there as our organization was to really to accompany the government, to provide a lot of support for that kind of planning. Sometimes it was simple things like gasoline in cars and paying for internet and helping rehab some offices centrally so that we could give the government a place to work and space to work in. And even when our own sort of philosophy in some cases took a bit of a backseat around payment of community health workers or whatever, we said, okay, you know, it's your country, we'll try to do the best we can. So I think there are examples of that, but it's not simple, and I think we need to be kind of militant about that approach, even from the private sector or from the NGO, you know, sector, which is also private. If we don't sort of help these governments to do a better job, as much as we can, seconding people, sitting with people, helping them do planning, we're going to fail because a country like Haiti, which has 10,000 NGOs, it's almost impossible for the government to make a plan that people will stick to. And so in Rwanda, we're down to about 200, and it's a little bit easier to coordinate 200 partners than 10,000. So I think it's a really important thing. And I just want to sort of say on cultural rights, maybe shouldn't be the last thing that we say, but I think that if you really engage community, they will help sort out cultural issues. You know, the cultural issues, you know, even here in San Francisco, I'm from Boston. I don't share your culture, right? I would rely on you to tell me where to get the best sushi or whatever you eat, you people eat out here. You know, you have to engage local people to understand. You know, everyone understood, for example, with Ebola, the funerals were a problem and whatever. My family's, I'm half Indian, but I'm also part Irish, right? If you've ever been to an Irish wake, there's a lot of touching of the body, right? And if we had Ebola in our family, you know, many people would have been infected. Was that a cultural thing that was insurmountable? Of course not. But engaging the right people in those dialogues who can really say, okay, yeah, how could we do this safely, giving them the knowledge, as Ava said. And you get a lot of wisdom if you take that approach. So I don't think the cultural piece is ever insurmountable if you're working together with local people and not sort of imposing just views from the outside to be carried out.
Great. Well, that really did kind of wrap everything up together. So we're building a really nice sandcastle. But I think some of the key elements here are, you know, interestingly, though, representing NGOs and private and also academia, I think that the message is to work with governments and engage communities, you know, and we are partners. But to make something sustainable, it really has to be investing in people in country and testing things out in country, you know, in partnership. And that is way how to really make it work in the long term. I think that it's really important also to think about our value systems, because really kind of putting equity in the middle of everything is where we have to kind of keep eye on the ball kind of and think about the values that we present and represent and how we engage. And I think the how is really, really critical in all of our global work. So I think that working together, I would say more than three, but those five sectors that we've been talking about, that we can all play in the same sandbox and make a really pretty castle, avoid epidemics in the future on the way. So I want to thank our wonderful panelists.
Thank you.
To see you,
thank
and
you.
Also to the audience.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.